This is Corolla Digital.
Allison Rose in. Hey everyone, it's me, Allison. On Thursday, I sat down with Chris Loxamana, Matt Fondelier, Gary Smith, and newish Corolla Digital employee Kaylin Bean, and we learned about the time Chris wore high heels and was chased by a pregnant woman who wanted the shoes when he was done with them. And then on Monday, I was joined by our very own Larry Miller, and we talked about all sorts of stuff, including his accident earlier this year and the secret to Chicken Larry. Subscribe to Allison Rosen is Your New Best Friend on iTunes or go to AllisonRosen.com. New episodes every Monday and Thursday. I love you.
Allison's your new best friend.
Now, it's time for this week's CarCast with your host, Adam Carolla, and moderator, Matt DeAndrea.
Yeah, get it on. Got to get it on. No choice but to get it on. And mandate, get it on. Welcome to yet another CarCast. Terry Cargis is here. Leslie Kendall is here as well. Both these guys from Peterson, and we'll clarify who does what a little later. Leslie is the chief curator over at the Peterson Automotive Museum. We've done a lot of stuff with them, and they got a lot of cool stuff going on. And Terry's executive director of the Peterson Automotive Museum, but also does a lot of stuff outside of that as well. I brought a car I can't stand just because I was traumatized by it, as you know.
Yeah.
It's one of the old yellers.
Yes.
Somebody fired it up, and it took 7 years off my life. But I will explain. I will explain later. A lot of changes going on over at the Peterson. I feel like it's the, you know, if you ask me about Los Angeles, I will tell you 2,000 things that Los Angeles does wrong. Uh-huh. But the Peterson Museum would not be on that list. And that's probably because guys like you are in charge, not guys like Villaraigosa.
It's definitely one of those places you have to stop by, whether you're really into cars or not. And the fact that you guys opened up the vault, basically the basement down there, and started doing those tours is so much fun. Really, it's something like 150 cars you have on display, but like another 150 in the basement that there's just not enough room to see unless you go down there and check it out. Actually, I don't even know that, Adam, you've even done the vault tour yet.
No, I go upstairs where the booze is.
Yeah, but it's pretty incredible down there.
Booze rises, son. Don't ever forget that.
Does it?
Rises
booze
to the,
rises?
Rises right to the top like a nice booze slick. I'm not going down to David Jones' locker.
Oh, I see.
Sorry, Leslie. What were you going to say?
No. I was going to say that, you know, we have all these wonderful cars. We wanted to give people a chance to see them. So we opened the vault last holiday season, and it's proven really, really successful.
Well, it gives people a chance to feel like they're on the inside. They get on the other side of the velvet.
That's exactly correct. The vault was closed for 20 years, for the first 20 years of the museum's operation. The only people who got to see the cars down there were either VIP or press. And we thought, why are we hiding all these cars from the folks? So for an extra ticket price, we have a guided tour with a docent or a guide, and they tell you everything about all of the cars.
And you guys, I mean, the calendar is filled with events. I've been to the Trans Am event, the Carroll Shelby event. We did my event.
Yeah, I went to the Baja event. You guys did that.
Enzo's
that was cool.
Birthday. We've
doing movie screenings over there, too. You guys showed Rush recently. Doubled. And Snake of the Mongoose.
Just last night. We've doubled the number of events that we're doing. And what we're attempting to do is reach more of the automotive and motorcycle enthusiasts, the various groups and categories, because we've done a good job this year, I think. In fact, our attendance is up 24% just by inviting all the different groups in.
Plus, I've been there four times in the last few months.
Helped.
So that's
the probably numbers.
That's probably helped significantly.
Unlike other museums that just sort of put out something and then you walk through, this is ever evolving, and there's so many events. I mean, I think museums realize that in the old time, a museum was not proactive; it just was there, And, mm-hmm. you know, if somebody said to their kid, we're going to the museum, it's like, oh, God, yeah. please, dear, no, just kill me here, you know.
Right.
Now, the museum does not have the same sort of stink of failure and old people that Grandpa's museum has. This is
right.
fun. This is lively. It's interactive.
Right. It doesn't smell like mothballs and Bengay.
Right.
You'll find that most of the museums don't even refer to themselves as museums anymore.
Right.
Like the Henry Ford is in fact, now they call themselves the Henry.
Right.
The Hammer, the Getty.
Sure, sure. Know, right.
We're the Peterson.
Right. And by the way, an event coming up for all you guys who like the Japanese cars like myself. Saturday, November 9th is the Japanese car cruise. And I went to that several years ago. I think... If I'm not mistaken, my lightweight Roadster was front and center. Yeah.
Yeah.
I believe that was for the Japanese car cruise, and or it was called something else.
In fact, you have some of the great Japanese race cars of all time.
He's the tallest dwarf in Candyland.
That's right. That's pretty much it.
Yeah, thank you. No, I know. Listen, I feel that way. Screw those Italians over there. You know, I'm half Italian. I can call them that. I love the Japanese stuff. I love the history. And for so many years, it was, I don't know, it was almost a form of discrimination. Like, it was almost outright just discrimination. Like,
that's right.
We look down our noses at these Japanese cars. We have Ferraris and we...
Rice burners.
Yeah, that's right. And why should they have any place amongst all these these Mustangs and these Cobras mm-hmm. or these Ferraris or these birdcage Maseratis or whatever it is? And turns out they won a lot and they have a rich history.
Yeah.
And it goes way back. And by the way, Japanese are fanatical about racing.
Right. Mm-hmm. But when the Japanese cars won out here, people were like, that didn't count.
I know, but I mean...
It's all right. It didn't really count.
How much more winning do you have to do than, you know, for instance, Nissan and Datsun and... Nissan and Mazda and Honda and Toyota off-road especially, but on the road course as well. I mean, this guy's... Mm-hmm. Have done a lot more over the last... You know, it's not like Mercedes-Benz... You know, they took 50 years off. You know, what's the big whoop over there? So why not? But again, I think it had the Japanese stigma to it.
Well, when Nissan got into IMSA and they were running GTP with Jeff Brabham driving, they dominated everything. And then Gurney got involved with Toyota and they dominated everything they did. Chris Cord won the GTO championship with Willie T. Ribbs in a GTO.
What a great name.
Great
Willie
name.
T. And then they went IndyCar racing with him, and GTP, they dominated. They crushed the competition in GTP.
Yeah. Right. But, you know, 962s and 950-whatevers, I mean, those are considered so iconic. And then you see the Nissan stuff, and nobody really gives a shit. Except for me.
That's right. Except for you.
Although
you're the guy.
I can't fit in the well, that's not a GTP car, but it's close to it.
The 95 Nissan, the 300, that ZX they have back, the Jerry O'Connell and the John Morton and Steve Millen guys.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're all about my height.
Yeah.
And that seat is like, there's a firewall in the back. The seat can't move.
So are you suggesting you should be the driver?
That's what I'm saying. <It's> like...
Yeah, we'll go down to Denny's. We'll get one of those booster seats, and we'll just put it in there, and Matt can pilot the car.
That's it. I like those.
So what's
I can see everything?
What's coming up, Peterson-wise? Tell us about the massive facelift and more than a facelift that's going on with the museum or the Peterson. So.
We're in the really about to transform the museum inside and out. The exterior, if you go on peterson.org, you can see a picture or a rendering of what the exterior will be. It's a series of stainless steel ribbons that encircle the building, and it's nothing short of spectacular. Cohn Pedersen Fox from New York is one of the top three architectural firms in the world. And they were challenged, give us an idea of what we can do to the building without having to build a new building.
Mm-hmm.
But it has to represent speed. Gene Cohn was in. He came back 8 weeks later with a presentation. He's a car guy. this was his idea, and it's fabulous.
Now, it looks, you can say, it looks like you're above a windy road, multiple windy roads that are just sort of all going together. So it has that feeling, but also looks like it has a lean to it, like it's moving left to right. Is the shape, I can't tell from this rendering, is it
having... It's going to be taller up here on this one side and then...
Over the parking?
Well, it'll lip up over the fourth floor where we have a penthouse for events and parties.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
But
that's
it won't cover that. It will not cover the parking garage.
Does the shape of it resemble anything other than what we're looking at now?
It was an interpretation of speed, their
right.
idea of speed, and that's something that we could do. Also, we'll have this done in the next 18 months.
Uh-huh.
So remarkable in an amount of time.
It's going to be all backlit? Those ribbons are going to be backlit like that? Like it's in the rendering?
Correct.
Or?
Against the building will be a layer of corrugated red steel painted hot rod red.
Mm-hmm.
And then we'll use LED lighting to backlight it. So the evening will be even more spectacular than daytime.
Adam painted his fridge and his kitchen hot rod red.
I was a little more terracotta.
That's where we got the idea.
You guys,
Tony was in your kitchen. He saw the fridge. He's like, let's do it like this.
Ripped off my idea.
Yeah.
But we're going to do the interior as well. In fact,
seen these yet. That's cool.
Isn't that great?
Yeah.
We're working with some ex-Disney Imagineering folks.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking to a company called Scenic Route, which is a set decorators, some ex-Universal Studios creatives.
Mm-hmm.
About what can we do in the interior that is actually it'll be transforming, but it'll also be immersive. You'll be able to experiential. You'll have be able to participate more. Right now, the museum that exists today was built 20 years ago by the Natural History Museum using 100-year-old display techniques.
Mm-hmm.
So we will become a 21st century museum.
Is the building is just 20 years old?
No, the building itself was built in 62.
That's what I thought. Yeah. It seemed older than
It was a store or something, right?
It's like a department store.
Three. Yeah.
Right.
Seiku department store opened in 62.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then they closed a few years later, and Orbox came in 1968.
My grandmother's favorite place to shop was the Orbox. I think there's one in the valley. Not anymore, but it was a big deal. Going to the ore box. We're looking at some scars.
It's an outing.
Not squeezing the trigger on anything yet. Just looking. Just looking. Wait till they go off season.
That's right.
That's when we make our move.
In the summer, scarves are cheap.
Yeah, that's right. Going to the ore box looking for stuff.
Yeah.
Remember this shit? Remember the clothes shop? Everything used to be a big deal. Now it's like, go to Old Navy and just spend $20 and get 5 pair of cargo shorts. But it was the old oral grandma. She's somewhere up there in heaven, possibly hell, listening to this right now.
She's got the scarf on.
She's got that scarf.
Fucking love this scarf. Got a deal on it. Lasts
I
forever.
Told you're not going to need that scarf where you're going, Grandma. It's warm. It's plenty warm.
Whoa.
So the museum, where does the museum raise, where does the lion's share of the funds come for doing this kind of multi-million dollar endeavor?
It'll primarily be individual donors.
Mm-hmm.
We're working with
Bruce
banks
Meyer.
Right now.
Hey, Bruce.
Bruce.
Yeah.
Get your
Hi,
checkbook
Bruce.
Out.
Get your
Come
checkbook
on over.
Out, Bruce.
Yeah, step right up. Adam, we certainly expect you.
I do the Japanese cars. Bruce, the one with the pontoon Testarossa over there.
Yep.
Is that car gorgeous? The Von Neumann Testarossa?
Oh, my God. That thing was on – that thing was up there for I don't know how long. It's back at his place now, I guess. That is one of those – the pontoon – and I don't know – I guess it is a pontoon Ferrari. Not a pontoon. Good, because I don't like the look of the pontoon.
Leslie's shaking his head.
Much.
This is why Leslie's
not
here.
It's not
quiet,
a pontoon. But it's 55. I don't know what year.
57, 58. It's a genuine Scaglietti body on a TR chassis, and it's no less sexy.
I don't aesthetically like the look of the pontoon as much as I like the look of Bruce's car.
Yeah, Bruce has the car. If you're going to have one, that's the car to have. It's like an Italian hot rod.
Yeah.
Wait. What is that? Do we have a picture of that somewhere?
Yeah, we have it somewhere. We were up there. The thing about that, you know, somebody just been tweeting me that some race GTO went for $53 million.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah, I heard about that. Most expensive auction car now.
Bruce, that is not a GTO, but when a GTO goes for $53 million, Bruce Meyer has to think, thanks for tacking $5 million onto the price of mine.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
More rare Ferrari from 10 years earlier.
I lost my bid at 51.5.
Yeah. That's when you put the paddle down?
That's it. It's like, that's enough.
Are we doing it over the phone?
Yeah. I was an internet bidder.
Getting upset.
What do you think that Bruce car is worth? With that GTO going for 52.
Oh, I would say his car, any car with that kind of provenance would probably be worth well into eight figures. How far into eight figures, I wouldn't be sure.
But yeah,
more than I have on me right now.
I wouldn't think it would go for, after the $53 million GTO, mm-hmm. I wouldn't think that thing's going for less than $10 million. But anyway, that's why I got to hit up Bruce.
What was it that just sold for $500,000 in Scottsdale this year? Flares and Chairs.
The Dino.
Dino?
Yeah.
Flares and Chairs, Dino.
Yeah.
Also good name of a gay country bar. You know what I mean?
Flares and Chairs?
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm just saying. If you're thinking about, or, you know, a gay-themed, country-themed bar, Flares and Chairs.
Okay.
Flares and Chairs are that's the Dino that has those rear flares, the metal flares, and the Daytona-type seats. Mm-hmm. Do you know the Flares and Chairs?
No.
A little rich for your blood.
Yeah.
He's a Fox body Mustang.
Yeah.
Man.
Yeah.
He doesn't go much
it's delivered, by the way. I have to tell you about
he knows Fox and Trots. That's another
that's
gay.
Right. That's right.
That's another gay Western-themed bar.
I love how all of Bruce Meyer cars, they become Bruce Meyer. Like, that's the new name of the car. There's the Bruce Meyer 935 Porsche. There's the Bruce Meyer Testarossa. There's the Bruce Meyer Cobra. You know, they all sort of... Get his name stamped on
there,
which is fun.
This one out. Maybe Terry or Leslie knows. I know, Terry, you worked doing some stuff with Newman back in the day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So the Bruce Meyer 935 that won Le Mans overall in 80?
It's one of two production-based cars to win overall.
One of two. Ever.
One of two ever.
And Bruce doesn't have them both?
Meaning, what a loser.
God.
Loser. Yeah. Meaning the overall winner of Le Mans was something that rolled out of a factory at some point and then was made into that?
It was a factory-built race car. But it was
right, but I mean,
the base
of it was a 911, right?
Right.
Right, and there's a picture up now.
That's such a cool looking car, by the way.
That
we'll throw up some pictures, but this, what a cool looking car.
What was the other one? By the
way,
do you recall?
I don't recall.
So maybe Bruce.
Probably a Porsche.
Yeah, makes sense, and maybe wouldn't be later.
Actually,
be earlier, right?
Might have been earlier.
I think it would have been earlier.
Eddie told me that Porsche went to Le Mans 19 times before they won.
Wow,
that was a staggering figure.
They were just getting warmed up.
Yeah,
obviously. Now, I know Newman ran it in 79 or 80.
In a Porsche.
935. And the Hawaiian Tropic one.
Yeah.
The Dick Barber one.
Mm-hmm.
And he came in second, I think, in his class. But maybe overall. I can't recall. But I'm trying to figure out if he was racing in the same year. And we got to figure this one out. Did he race the same year when that one won overall?
I don't believe so.
He must have raced the year before. It wasn't the year after. If that was 80, well, we'll figure it out.
Yeah.
But 935s, as I found out on the track, are very effective cars.
Yeah. Yeah. And when Bruce Kennep was driving them, they're not slow.
They work better. Yeah.
The definition of putting the hammer down.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes. So, donations, and then and it's good because this is a dedicated group of really enthusiastic rich white guys.
We talk about Bruce. We talk about Bruce Meyer. Bruce has been involved in the museum since the beginning with Mr. Peterson. In fact, he and Bob Peterson had the discussion about putting the museum together. Our current chairman, Peter Mullen, was involved from the very beginning. In fact, Leslie, that you were there. Leslie's been the curator at the museum for 20 years, our whole history. And How many of Peter Mullen's cars were on display when we opened?
Well, the entire Grand Salon was full of Peter's French classic cars. It was extraordinary. We had probably 12 or 14 of them. From the very beginning, and that's still one of the exhibits that's best remembered.
See, these guys support the museum because they got so many cars, they got no place to put them.
Free storage.
Yeah. Now, that's it. They're like, oh, I'll display it at the museum. There's like a Bruce Meyer Hall or something because he's got so many cars, he's got no place to put them.
The one guy who doesn't drop off a lot of cars is Leno.
Yeah.
And he doesn't drop off because it's not because he's not into cars, because he's too into cars. I don't know what you do with the guy, but I've talked to him about it. He's like, man, why are you dropping your car up there? I said, well, they wanted my car. I let them have my car. What are you going to do? You can't start. You got to start it. You got to drive it. You know, yeah. I don't know what to say. It's going to be there for like nine months. What are you going to do? And I was like, he's so nuts about his cars. I don't think it's the I won't let them out of my sight. It's like he can't have his car
sit. He can't get in it and drive it around.
Drive it to NBC.
Yeah.
Aren't most of his cars runners, too? I mean,
every one of them. Yeah. Every one of them. Yeah.
I love that about him.
Single.
Every one of them he drives. Yeah. That was his thing. And the truth is like the mirror that you had was in that great exhibit that you guys put together in the museum for a while. It was something like 9 months. Mm-hmm. And then it's when we took it off the truck, we put it in the back of the shop, and it's been sitting there for a year. So it still hasn't started.
I'm no Jay Leno. I never claimed to be. But I can tell you this. He has, 250 cars. I don't think he drives the tank car into NBC, but he just drives a different car every single day. And the last time I was over there, I said, I want to take a good look at that Maserati 3500 because that's a cool little car going up in value. I've always liked them a lot. I've always liked that big straight six in there, and I just thought the Maserati 3500, I just always thought it was a very Italian cool car that never was a little underappreciated in a world of Porsche and a world of Ferraris and things like that and Lamborghinis. This was one that was a little underappreciated, and I know he did the whole work. He worked on the whole car and fixed it up and did all that. So last time I went over there, I was like, I'm coming over there. I want to check out that car.
Yeah,
I went over there and like, Jay took it into work. I was like, the one car.
Yeah.
I've seen every other car here. And the one car he took, the one out of 200 cars a guy drives, the one that I want to come over there and see, it's sitting at NBC right now while I'm sitting in a very different part of Burbank.
It was a joke on you. Lynette called, gave him the heads up.
I am going over there later on today to have him make a plastic part for me and his CNC thing.
Check on the brake calipers while you're there.
Oh, yeah.
He's got the Camaro brake calipers.
I'm redoing another Newman car, trying to get some brakes fixed. So what did you do with Newman back
in the
day? I was
the Budweiser track rep during the Can-Am era when it was Newman Freeman Racing. Mm-hmm. He ran the Can-Am program.
Crazy, huge
what years were those?
Can-Am car.
What years were you working on that?
79, 80, 81. It was some of the best racing I've ever seen. It was a... In fact, it started off, Bill Freeman had hired Elliot Fords Robinson, who was also a friend of Newman's. And Elliot had been testing all winter at Willow.
Mm-hmm.
And Freeman was trying to hire a French Formula One driver. And I suggested, why don't you test K.K. Rosberg? I've seen him in Atlantic cars, and I know he's running Formula B. They brought Rosberg over. He was lightning fast. It was incredible to watch this guy drive. The first race was at Road Atlanta, and on the very last lap of qualifying, Jackie Ickx qualified him in the Haas Lola, and so Rosberg, who had a broken wrist from a race at Nürburgring the weekend before, asked Newman, "Where are you going to sit for the race, Mr. Newman?" He said, "I'll be at turn one." And in those days, it was just a small grandstand for about 15 people. Rosberg passed Ickx on the high side of turn one, which is impossible at Road Atlanta, on the first lap. It was stunning, and led the rest of the race.
What KK? I thought it was Kiki.
KK.
That's KK.
That's what I called him that the first time, and I was corrected.
Yeah,
really.
All this time, Adam.
Maybe it's,
all this time.
Bruin basketball great Kiki Vandeweghe that screwed things up for KK. But Wow, it's weird. So I think everyone mispronounced his name. It's KK.
Over here, yeah.
Oh,
over
okay.
Here, yeah.
Where is he from?
Finland. The Flying Finn.
Is he still around?
Oh, he's his son is Formula One for Mercedes.
Makes sense. So the Can-Am world, as I understand it, and then you can tell me, and the big Budweiser Newman car was just a behemoth. I mean, these cars were scary-looking cars.
The right. Budweiser Spiders.
Yeah. And there were, I've only seen pictures, but they looked like very big cars.
They were more like Formula One cars with big bodies on them.
A lot of body work.
Yeah,
a lot of body work. And so tell me how this worked, and correct me if I'm wrong. So Can-Am starts late 60s, early 70s. Well, anyway, don't stop me. And they got a bunch of guys, a bunch of big blocks, and Hillborn Injection, and big stacks, and all that kind of stuff. And then Porsche comes around, and Porsche makes these 1,100 horsepower cars that are destroying everything everyone. Right. Yeah. So they're kicking the shit out of everybody. And so what are you going to do? I mean, you have a naturally aspirated big block, and you're making 670 horsepower, but this guy's making 1,100 horsepower.
Yeah, at half the weight.
At half the weight, and he's flying past everybody. All right, what happens then with Porsche and the next generation of Can-Am as it gets into the late 70s and early 80s?
They actually dominated so much that the series ended. No one. There was nobody to race.
They don't change the rules. They don't change the cars. But like,
no, they crushed the competition.
They're like the Klitschko brothers. Everyone just went, screw it.
Yeah. We'll fight anybody except them.
Everyone got tired of heavyweight boxing because they just got tired of these guys winning.
Penske and Donahue would show up, and there was no reason to run. It was like first and then everybody else, and it was way, way back.
Mm-hmm.
At Riverside, you've got a mile. They had a mile straightaway, and by the end of the first couple of laps, it was, where's the field?
Right,
There was no reason to race. And so the 78, 79 was a rebirth of Can-Am.
They made some rules. No really good engineering.
Right. That's right.
Knock it off.
Yeah. Don't do so well. That's the rule. Do less good.
Yes.
I will share with you one of my favorite Newman moments was at breakfast at Watkins Glen. The waitress came over and said, "Oh, well, what are you going to have this morning, Mr. Newman?" He said, "I'll have love, money, and power, and not necessarily in that order." That was great.
Wow. Somebody woke up on the right side of the bed.
Being the Budweiser track rep sounds like the greatest job in history.
It was unbelievable. I mean, the Can-Am racing was so exciting with the guys that were in at that point, but also the IMSA racing. We were sponsoring Porsches. So every race we would go, and whoever was the fastest qualifier got the Bud money for the weekend.
Uh-huh.
So, and we'd decorate the cars right then. It was a little primitive, but a lot of fun.
And how much Bud was consumed?
Oh, mercy.
Newman. Well, Newman had some Z cars with some Bud. With some Bud, Bud logos on there, plenty of them.
That was Bud was his real sponsor after the Planters and the Datsun Nissan factory stuff.
And there was plenty of there's the big Bud Can-Am car.
I didn't even know Paul Newman drove these cars.
He was a team guy.
That was Teo Fabi.
Let's hurry up and finish the documentary so I can learn more about this.
No, you do know. He didn't drive those cars.
No, Teo came in after KK and Elliot were gone.
Yeah. Newman was a co-team owner, and then he was driving. Newman would have been driving the big Z cars about the same time the Can-Am
stuff was going on
out there. But Newman...
Right.
I've seen plenty of footage of him cracking a Bud after
Yeah,
a
that's
race.
What I was kind of getting at. Is he seemed to, that was sort of his go-to drink, from what I understand. Like it was,
he enjoyed a cool beverage.
Always after the race.
Always after.
Yeah. That's right.
He does it Vic Edelbrock style.
That's right. The margarita started 5 p.m.
4:59.
We
you
showed up
at 4:58.
We're like, "How about you heat up that blender, old man?" He's like, 2 minutes.
2 minutes. And he's like, "You were out of line. You were, son, take a step back. This only happens at 5.
Yeah, Edelbrock, You don't fire up that margarita machine until
5
straight up. He's got to call Zurich and make sure that the atomic clock over there says 5 p.m. And then he can
fire it up. Margarita time.
Yep. And there's old Paul with the Budweiser right behind him.
P.L.
Yeah. And it was a nice combination for him because, like I said, I think the guy liked his Budweiser.
Yeah.
So nothing better. You know, you don't want to be, you don't want some maxi pad company. you don't want them sponsorship. It's
right.
Not, no real practical application for
right.
you. He had a practical. They used to say, oh, he'd get Bud. He'd get a couple cases of Bud and go up, hang up the
more
crew.
Than a, more
right,
than
right,
a few
right.
Cases.
You want to get sponsored by the guy, by the products that you use. Most people go with tire companies. Right.
The first time I ever saw K.K. Rosberg, Kiki Rosberg.
That's right.
Right. Run was in the hot pink Excita Rubbers car.
We know who has that car.
Yeah.
Wait. Hold on a second. Is that a former
Atlanta car. Yeah. Billy Cord has the blue Excita car, and I don't know who has the hot pink, but that was...
In fact, there
was a poster. One of the great racing posters was Rosberg crossed up. In opposite lock, with still pointing down, and with the pedal on the floor, in the hot pink car.
I will tell you who has that car. Shit! I got to scratch my brain here for a second. That's
wow! That's impressive.
That's the car. Is that the car?
That's the car.
The guy. Oh, I'll think of his name. One of the guys I race with, one of the alpha guys from B Sedan, has that car. I mean, I was talking to him about bringing it out to the Historics, the Rolex Historics, and he was getting a little pushback. Because I think the guys in the Chitty Chitty Bang Bang mobiles didn't like the kind of mobile.
Yeah, the guys in Monterey, they love those cars. Chitty Chitty Bang Bang.
I will. by the way, if you're doing a race and you're Laguna Seca and there's somebody in the passenger seat and they're hanging on to their hat, that's not a race car.
Right. I do like the goggles and the leather helmet and the Snoopy scarf.
I appreciate it, but come on now, make a little room for the condom mobile.
Yeah.
Would you?
Well, but all those guys, they dress up while they're there and they've got a whole thing going on.
All right. I'll try to think of
that. So what, Leslie, what events or not events, what exhibits are going on at the museum currently and how long are they going for?
Well, we have some pretty interesting things. We have an exhibition on fins. We call it Form Without Function. We talk about those appendages that first bloomed in the late 1940s on American cars and then went away in the mid-60s. We have an exhibition right now also on pickup trucks. A lot of people, when they think of car museum, they don't think of, pickup trucks as automobiles, but boy, they sure are. And, we talk about some of the earliest dating back to, the near turn of the century international, right on up to a modern concept pickup truck by Isuzu.
Yeah, like what vehicle in this country sells more than a pickup truck, right? Like we sell more trucks than anything else.
Yeah, you're right. It's the most popular kind of vehicle, and it's, it really speaks to what Americans like about cars and like about freedom.
Wow, we're looking at a great finned boat.
And fins didn't stop on cars. They ended up on boats, and even the boat trailer has fins.
You'll note that it was hot pink.
Yeah.
Yeah,
like the condom mobile.
that's what we were going for.
Think of that guy's name.
Yeah.
The guy. It's a guy from eBay. Or the guy handles...
Martin.
Martin, yeah. Guy handles eBay. I think Martin... I don't know Martin's last name, but I think
Lauber.
Oh yeah, Martin Lauber. I think Martin has that car. I think I spoke to him about that car. Go to Martin Lauber.
What did he have in
Facebook page?
What did he have in Coronado that you got into? We squeezed you into.
That was a Formula V or something, or Formula Atlantic this is a Formula V.
Skinny
Coronado.
Tires, no wings.
Yeah.
This is kind of fit.
It was Formula something, but
open wheel. deal. It was just like, yeah.
Yeah.
Just to see if you can fit in there, we put them in there. And not a lot of room. Not a lot of room to move your elbows and turn the wheel.
Plus, the wheel was, you know, 7.5 inches around.
Yeah,
or something.
It's small.
It's off-putting.
Yeah.
It's off-putting. It's,
you know, I was just at the Indy race in Houston this past weekend. If you heard about that crazy crash.
I did.
We were in one of the hospitality rigs right on the – there was a corner, and then right after that corner, they hit the straight and just flew. That thing was nuts. And this is what I'm saying about the open wheel cars is that's some dangerous shit.
Yeah. Oh, my God.
There it is. Yeah. X-Kiki – I'm sorry, KK – XKK.
Yeah, race by Martin Lauber.
Race by Martin Lauber. There you go. That's KK's X car.
So I'm going to mention that these images are awesome. You're going to have to check these out on our Facebook page.
Yeah, you can go to the website too. So that race, Dario Franchitti was in that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And how was he doing?
He was doing well. That I remember, and it was weird that it happened on the straight. Like the other car came up behind him and it hit, and he just launched. And you know, of course, it looks so dramatic. I mean, obviously it was, but it looks so much more dramatic because those cars are meant to just break apart and keep the cockpit in one piece. So just pieces of carbon fiber and stuff. But what happened was, it hit. There's the fence and sort of the safety net to you know, block the spectators. And where the accident happened was right in front of the grandstands. And a piece of the car hit the fence and just sheared the metal. And
it sheared the fence.
Sheared the fence.
Wow.
And then afterward, because we walked by when they cleared out the crowd, and the fence that was above the cement that blocks the cars is up on the top of the grandstands. It flew up there and landed on people.
Wow.
It was just absolutely nuts. And Dario says he's okay. He's got a couple surgeries I think he's going through on his ankle, and he fractured some vertebrae and stuff. But he was awake, and he was sending out Twitter messages, which is good. You can see the photo, or at least there's a piece of it.
Whoa.
But you see there's the fence, and then it kind of tilts over.
Right.
Well,
I can't figure.
Those metal bars, those sheared off and landed right in the top of the grandstands over to the right in this video that we're looking at.
How did he
It was
get,
just nuts.
How did he get launched?
Somebody hit him.
I know.
Yeah, and it just.
No, I understand it wasn't an act of God.
What I'm saying
is somebody came behind him. I know, I saw it, and it's just somehow he's airborne.
The
but,
front of the car is so low, it came up and almost scooped him up.
Right.
And launched him up. And then I think they said there was 13 people were injured. Two people went to the hospital. I don't think anybody was really bad, which is great. But when we were sitting there watching it, you can hear it, and you're like, wow, it is absolutely insane. And I haven't really gone to many of these Indy races. Long Beach, this is the first one I flew out there.
You will not be invited back.
No.
And now it's sort of big. We can see
here's the footage
of it.
You'll see.
Boom.
So it's basically the front end got in the air, and the second the front end gets in the air, you're going up.
Yeah, and you can't really tell from that angle. Maybe it either got underneath the car and pitched it up, or the front touched the rear tire, and it's because it's spinning, it just launches the car.
Either way, the question always is this. You know, just when they think they have one problem solved, they realize they're vulnerable somewhere else. And I don't know what you do outside of this fencing, because now someone's going to go, well, we can no longer have, you know, the cyclone fencing with the cable's not enough anymore. We're going to have to do some sort of Kevlar net or something.
I mean, that's a tough call, because the safety fencing and stuff that's there did its job.
It kept the car in.
Mm-hmm. It kept the car in, and it kept most of the debris from flying over, but it was just such a hard hit. It was just a one in a million shot that it just sheared some of the metal pylons that hold the fence together. It was a big piece of fence up in the grandstands. It was really kind of nuts.
But, and the pole?
Yeah, it because the pole that holds the fence, you know, from pole to pole, it cut that pole.
Wow.
It just cut it and just
went
up.
Let's get down to brass tacks. How much beer was spilled?
I did not spill a drop, my friend.
Okay.
Not one drop.
Well, good that no one was seriously injured. And Dario appears to be okay.
Yeah, he's clearly out for a while.
But a good,
he seemed to be – and he was in good spirits about the whole thing. He was sending out Twitter messages, so that's good.
a good guy and a great guy, and in a way, a testament to how safe the cars are, because that accident looked brutal.
Yeah, you watch the footage, and it's just carnage everywhere. When we walk past the track, and you just pieces everywhere. It was insane. And then they stopped all the racing for the day. There were some of the guys who were supposed to go out in the Mazda spec cars and stuff like that, and they just canceled everything.
By the way, so speaking of our good friend Martin, talking about earlier, eBay, baby. I got my blog out there. I think we're doing the Aventadors out there. It's the one that's currently out there, right?
Yeah.
People dig that car. $450K should be decent. You know, I...
Before the taxes.
I had I had somebody say to me, what's, you know, car guys, un-car guys, non-car guys, douchebags, as we call them. They said, well, what's the difference between a $100,000 car and a $450,000 car? And I said, oh, you could tell. I mean, in the car world, you can tell.
Yeah.
And they said, I said, listen, I understand what you're saying. If you went down and got a bottle from the basement of some castle, the Chateau Lafite 1955, and poured it with some Trader Joe's $9 wine next to it, and as long as you put a piece of duct tape over the label, yeah, I don't think I would be able to tell you which one I liked more. As a matter of fact, there's a pretty good chance I'm going to like the Trader Joe's.
Yeah, it's 50-50. It's
better
whatever
than the $4,000 bottle of wine. But in the cars, oh yeah. You can get in the car. You can see it there. I mean, you fire that naturally.
There's no mistake in that.
I called it a 5.5 naturally aspirated, but maybe it's 6 or something. I don't know.
In the Lamborghini?
Yeah.
Yes, it's bigger than 5.5.
All right. Don't laugh at me. It's not that much bigger. It's 6.2 or something like that. And I said 640 horsepower. I don't know what the hell that thing's got. Naturally aspirated, but something
in
that.
Yeah, I think it's around those.
Somewhere in there. So you press the start button, that thing kicks on behind your head, and you'll know where the first 150 grand went.
Yeah, 6.5 liter.
Oh, 6.5.
Is that 690 horse? 690.
Jesus Christ.
Almost 700 horsepower. And what's crazy is that kind of horsepower on a naturally aspirated engine, I don't care what the engine is, it's going to sound nuts.
Right. All right.
It has to.
So you want to read the blog, you go to ebaymotorsblog.com and also the eBay Motors app. This is good for what ails you. You're hanging around. You got some time. Put on your phone.
Yeah.
Getting in the airport. Whatever. Just cruise around. Check. That's what I do. I just putz around. I just type in. I'll type in a make. Type in, like, you know, Ferrari, Lamborghini, sometimes Alfa Romeo, just anything. Datsun. I'll just type in the make, and then I'll go to the part, and I'll go oldest first. And that's the fun part. You go, what is the oldest Datsun that's on eBay right now? What's the oldest Lamborghini that's on eBay right now? Just what is the oldest? And it's just fun. Because, I don't want to look at a whole bunch of, brand new Sentras. But I will go back and see if there's a Roadster on there. Why not?
Do the old stuff first. Oldest Corolla?
Yeah, oldest Corolla. That's my dad. You want to support the CarCast? CarCastShow.com. You can go on and donate. Hit the PayPal. Donate a few bucks. Nice to keep everyone paid around here. And, we keep racing and keep bringing you the footage and bring the cars in and the guests in. And you give a little something back. That's the way it works. It's a symbiotic relationship.
Yep.
Peterson, people should go online.
Yeah.
And they should find out all the cool events that are coming up. I know here that you guys are going to be on October 24th. You're going to be honoring Patrick Dempsey and Ken Block and Jeff Beck. I didn't know Jeff Beck, guitar player, Jeff Beck?
Yeah. Jeff actually is a walking encyclopedia on hot rods. He has a 15-car garage at his home in the U.K., does his own metal work, his own engine work, and if he wasn't playing guitar, he'd be in hot rod business.
Wow.
Yeah, he's a real, real fan and a knowledgeable guy.
Well, the hell knew?
He walked through the museum a couple months ago with us and was giving us the history of everything there. Who built it, why they built it, how they chose the colors. I mean, it was amazing.
Well, see if he knows why they call the Dinos the flares and chairs.
I've
got a good one for you. Leslie might be able to verify this story. Carroll Shelby had Peter Brock do a car or design a car with Di Tommaso.
Wow.
And then never took delivery of it. And you saw the car.
Mm-hmm.
And so evidently Mr. DiTommaso was not real happy that Carroll did not ever take delivery on the car, went on, and he was building Cobras. DiTommaso's first car, as I understand it, was the Mangusta,
mm-hmm.
which is Italian for mongoose because it's the only animal on the planet that can kill a cobra.
Interesting.
Is that great?
Leslie, did we see that car? Or we saw a sort of Italian-bodied Corvette-powered something.
Scaglietti-body.
Scaglietti, yeah, all right.
We own a 1955, one of the three, and incidentally, Carroll Shelby has something to do with it, one of the three Corvette Italias, they call them, built
right.
in 1959. Exactly.
But the Mangusta we're speaking of.
The Mangusta at –
Oh, that was a – this was a – it wasn't a Mangusta. It was a
– P-70.
Yeah, P-70.
Uh-huh.
It's a one-off. Actually, I guess the car had been disassembled because no one did anything with it and storage for 40 years.
Mm-hmm.
And DiTommaso's son is selling off a lot of the property and took over the business and found the car. And it was just sold at auction for a lot of money.
That sounds about right. So the website where people can go online and just see all what's going on the calendar.
Peterson with all E's. .org.
And check that out. There are tickets available, I believe, for this for the gala event for October 24th.
You bet.
It's a fundraiser event, so check it out. And I bet that's going to be awesome. Adam was – we were all at it last year. You were honored last year. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
You and John Lasseter, we had a great time. Brought some Mangria, I think.
Yeah. Brought our own.
Brought our own Mangria.
All right. Let's go out in the parking lot and see what you guys brought. Leslie has brought us my arch nemesis, the Old Yeller 4.
You love this thing.
This is a fabulous car. It's actually Old Yeller 3. It's the third one that he built. He built the car in 1959 for Haskell Wexler, a pretty well-known Hollywood camera guy in the day. And it was actually the only Old Yeller that Max Balchowski ever built that was intended primarily for street use, not as a racing car, although it was such a well-engineered vehicle that it was actually raced and with some success.
What's it built on? Is it to start off as something, the chassis or something?
The chassis was actually designed on the floor of his garage in North Hollywood using a piece of chalk. He laid it out and welded up the steel tubes to make his own unique frame over which he hammered aluminum body panels. It's very lightweight, but it's a serious car.
And now Max built a lot of Cadillac engines, but this is a engine?
This is a Buick engine. It's a Buick Nailhead, not the best breathing engine in the world because of the small valves, but boy, potent, very potent in this application. This thing can really move down the road.
So
it's essentially a big block?
It is a big block, you bet. A big block in a car that does not weigh a great deal. Very comfortable to drive, I might add. The seats are comfortable. The driving position's comfortable. He built it, actually, with a full-width windscreen because mm-hmm. it is a sports car, so it's comfortable for two people. It has doors, unlike a lot of cars in the era.
Yeah. See, if I rode in this car, I'd be like, hey, where's my roll bar? Don't worry about it, sweetie. You duck if we go over.
The supplemental roll bar option.
Yeah. What happened to me is, and this one looks like, it's not quite just a straight open pipe. I don't know if some of the racing versions were, but I was at a very nice mixer up at Pebble Beach, and it was one of those, you know, country club gigs where, you know, I think it was put on by, you know, doers or something,
right.
And there were guys in kilts teaching you how to get drunk, you know, and you're looking around drinking it, I don't know, Blue Label or Johnny Walker, whatever. And so everyone's just sitting around, you know, literally like chamber music on top of this hill.
No, those are the best events, but there's an alcohol consultant.
Free food, and there's a guy in a kilt helping you get drunk. And I was just standing there, and I was probably about this far away, and I was talking to some guy that was facing this way, and I'm holding my Johnny Walker or whatever. And the guy, Old Yeller's there, and the guy's going to he's going to fire it up, but he ain't going to say anything. So he's got a whole bunch of people just with their back turned.
No clear, no fire in the hole.
There's nothing. No and it's more. All you hear is like chamber music, you know? And we're all standing around looking at the sunset, you know, all of a sudden, and everybody just threw their crab cakes up in the air. And I was like, hey, man, sound, you know, do a... All right, people.
Yeah.
Fire in the hole.
Fire in the hole on the construction site. When they pull out that actuating it's a powder actuated pin driver. The Hilti gun. When that thing comes out,
I was gonna say that.
Fire in the hole, or you might hear the occasional earache, and then boom. But it gives you a minute just to poise yourself emotionally.
Something. Did you drop your booze?
Oh, no, I dropped everything off.
Threw up your crab cakes, but you got the drink. That's
good. This thing would have been out with the Ferraris and, I mean, I don't know if this, but I know Old Yeller would be out there with the pontoon Ferraris, I think, and maybe the birdcage Maseratis.
Exactly. This car actually harkens a little bit to the pontoon Ferrari. You can notice, you know, immediately behind the front wheels how cut in it is, and the bodywork extends inside of the exhaust headers. This car, it was called Old Yeller because it really, the idea was to give people an idea that it was a junkyard dog. Right. But not just any junkyard dog, because here's Max Belchowski, a guy doing things in his own backyard, putting together a combination of parts, engine, chassis that he built himself, body, everything that drubbed the Ferraris and Maseratis, everything in its way. It just cleaned up the racetracks. You know, that was a little embarrassing for a lot of car companies. Here, this guy, you know, from California comes in and kind of takes over with cars like this. And it has a certain sexiness to it.
How many did he end up making?
9.5. He was working on his 10th when he passed away. And
what year would that have been?
That would have been only about 12, 15 years ago.
Oh really?
So it wasn't all that long ago in important automotive race builder terms.
He made it into the 90s.
I think late 80s, early 90s, something like that. I think he did pretty well, and he was creative the entire time. He was creative right up to the end.
And at that time, I mean, now, you know, it was beyond the driveway. Whip it up in your garage point. Technologically at that point. But at this point, we're talking, what year is this?
This is 1959.
This point, a little in front of this point, it's like pretty easy math. Everyone's running the same spoked rims.
Right.
Everyone's basically on the same tire technology. Everyone's running a live rear axle. So it's like horsepower to weight ratio.
Yeah.
So you just go, I'm going to make a car that weighs 1,900 pounds, whatever. I'm going to put a big, huge V8 in it. You do the math.
Yeah.
Like no one else has a wind tunnel, so who cares?
Well, back in this day, the engineering was a lot more approachable. You could put the disparate parts together, and if you needed something special, you could make it yourself and reasonably expect it to do pretty well. Now cars are so complicated that it takes a cadre of engineers just to design, you know, two or three suspension components. And
you said the body is all aluminum,
mm-hmm.
but the frame is steel.
Oh yeah, it's welded steel too.
But really, at this point, the engine is the heaviest thing, and that's the only real weight of this car.
Exactly. The engine. Well, the body. I mean, there's some meat to the chassis because it's pretty stiff. It's a tube frame, but the engine is the single heaviest component to the.
Can we look
whole
at the engine? I'm curious to know how far.
Yeah, you bet.
It is. Let's open it
you
up.
You bet. Yeah.
And as far as Max Belchowski, what was his? His real claim to fame. I mean, what would Old Yeller? But what would he be known for, or most popular for?
Well, every car he made ended up being called Old Yeller. But he did Old Yeller. Old Yeller 2 is a pretty popular car. The first Old Yeller, by virtue of the fact that it was the first and put him on the map. Is probably one of the most pivotal cars that he
ever
did.
What was his background, or how did he make his living?
He was really a self-taught guy. He didn't have a lot of formal education in this, but he worked on plenty of hot rods and cars in his day, and he was one of those unique people that had just kind of a feel about the things. He had this innate intuitive sensibility that he could put things together, and he knew it worked. He also knew it didn't work.
And he.
damn it, I'm starting to have respect for this car.
It's hard not to.
We'll take it outside, we'll fire it up, and it'll scare the shit out of you, and all of this will be, you'll be back to where you were before.
Now, this is Buick Motors we discussed. Mm-hmm. He did Cadillac as kind of what I'm, I have old Hino Transport with one of his Cadillac motors in it. Transport. Oh, Leslie's licking his chops over there. Transport.
Cool. Yeah,
you guys got to do a Transport.
He's thinking of his exhibits.
You know, got to take it somehow.
This carried the old Datsun Roadster in this Hino Transport. But anyway,
it's one of those things Les made you buy. It's like, you need this for the Roadster. Come
that's
on.
Right.
You need this for the Roadster.
Very true.
Plus, you're the only one who would buy it.
That's true, too. He did Cadillac and Buick. You know, I mean, I think everyone else is between Ford, Chevy, and maybe a little Mopar in here. Why do you think he was a Cadillac Buick guy?
I don't know, but some people kind of go counter to the flow. They're kind of, it's a counterpoint, I guess is what you could call it. And, you know, maybe he was the kind of person who thought, well, everybody's doing this. Why don't I do this other thing? Let's see if I can tweak this engine that nobody's even looking at to get the maximum horsepower out of it.
I love that these control arms are all drilled out.
It's insane. It's everything is just jewel-like in its design, not necessarily execution.
Yeah,
because it is an old Yeller, it is a junkyard dog, but it's really well thought out.
You've got an engine that weighs 800 pounds.
200 pounds. Yeah.
So you drill them out for the lightweight, but look how far back it is behind.
It's a mid-engine.
It's a front mid-engine car.
Right.
So the balance is really good. And this thing, she can lift her skirts and run down the road.
Yeah.
This is a not just fast, but quick car.
I'm trying to figure out the front suspension here because I'm seeing a shock absorber. Mm-hmm. Do they have some sort of torsion suspension or where's the spring part that doesn't exist? I'm trying to figure out because that's like Porsche, you know, you go, well, either you have a spring or you have a leaf spring or you have the Porsche, like there's torsion.
There's a torsion arm here that's attached to the middle, but then it connects here and then it goes up that way.
Exactly. Oh, okay. It's a very, very long torsion arm that extends.
There's no sway bar basically going front side to side.
There is. Oh, it looks like down low, or maybe I'm looking at something
I think you can
else.
Even see it behind the exhaust pipes on the
but
outside.
But it's a torsion suspension.
It's not a coil spring.
Underneath, there's a small sway bar, but this torsion arm you're talking about goes all the way along the side there. But that's kind of a neat
idea.
It's
not a coil spring, definitely.
Yeah, a lot of really neat technology, and one of the coolest things ever, which is the massive drum brake. I love the huge cap on that. It's just a great vintage look.
Yeah, with the fins on it, the fin drums for heat dissipation. It's just so interesting, and all the, you know, and if you get up close, you can see all the little tube frames that he used to anchor and support the body, the coachwork.
Yeah.
And when the car was donated to us, it was donated by a Dr. Bruce Jacobs some years ago. He actually donated additional parts. He had another rear tail section, he had a front section, and like I mentioned before, the proper windshield for around town touring.
A really cool piece. Leslie Kendall, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank
Peterson
you,
Museum.
Peterson.org, is that right?
Peterson.org.
.org, and that's where you can find all the dates and all the events.
Yeah.
And we're going to take this thing outside and fire it up so you guys can hear it. I'm going to be at home, but it'll be fired up nonetheless. And until next time, this is Adam Carolla for Matt DeAndrea and Leslie, I almost said Peterson, Leslie Kendall, good racing name, saying keep the air in the spare and the bag in the wheel.